This past Sunday, August 25th, marked the 400th anniversary of the first recorded enslaved Africans arriving on what would become United States shores. In 1619, the first documented slave ship arrived in the English settlements that would become Jamestown, Virginia. An English pirate ship stole the human cargo from a Portuguese ship off the coast of Mexico and made its way to north to Jamestown. There are myriad ironies in the history of African slavery in the Western Hemisphere. One of the most obvious is that a theft started one of the most heinous exercises of human subjugation in modern history. Another is that a full century before, the Portuguese had enslaved Africans and brought them to work tobacco fields in Bermuda, so the number is far larger than 400. But a fitting final irony is that during the same time, what is known as the foundation of modern representative democracy was being created in Jamestown, Virginia. At the same time, English pirates sold enslaved Africans to the very same founders of modern democracy who were fighting for their own freedom and using enslaved Africans as free labor. Although there have been regional commemorations, nationally we still do not recognize the institution with a day of healing, teach the history in schools, or speak of the historical ramifications that influence our present. Why is that? Renowned legal scholar and author Professor Gloria Brown Marshall has written extensively on race and law from the 1600s to the present. She also chaired and curated the Association of the Study of African American Life and History, known as ASALA's 400th commemoration events. We'll talk about what she's found that could be the answer to why our country ignores its history of slavery, legal issues from the time that still haunt us today, and why remembering the history of chattel slavery is important to the healing of our country today on The Keenest Observers. Gloria J. Brown Marshall is a professor of constitutional law at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. She teaches classes in constitutional law, race, and the law, evidence, and gender injustice. She is a civil rights attorney who litigated cases for Southern Poverty Law Center in Alabama, Community Legal Services in Philadelphia, and the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Professor Brown Marshall is the author of many articles and several books, including The Voting Rights War, the NAACP and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice, and Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to present. She is the executive editor of the Report on the Status of Black Women and Girls. She is a playwright of 7 produced plays. Her most recent play in process is titled Class, about the racial fight over the American dream. And she is a syndicated columnist and legal commentator who covers the United States Supreme Court and major cases and has been called on to speak on them in major media outlets such as CNN, MSNBC, CBS, WVON. It's my pleasure to welcome Professor Gloria Brown Marshall to The Keenest Observers. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob.
Most definitely. Most definitely. You've written extensively on this issue, especially as it pertains to the legal structures that have kind of established American society from the beginning. How does the institution of slavery play a role in our American society?
Well, it is the cornerstone, as is Virginia and the Jamestown settlement. If you think about it, going back to what you said, when those 20 and odd Negroes, as was written in the journal of John Rolfe of Pocahontas fame, you're talking about another irony on top of the other irony. So John Rolfe notes this in his journal. John Rolfe is secretary for the Virginia colony. And these Africans arrive. There is no legal slavery in the colony because there's only been Europeans and the Native Americans. There was no legalized slavery. So the status of these Africans is still a matter of controversy. And here's why the irony of one irony becomes even more ironic, because the English today are making themselves out to be cogs in the wheel of slavery that the Portuguese, the French, and the Spanish had already started, and so they don't have dirty hands in this. They're just doing what everybody else was doing, which is actually untrue. What we have is these Africans arriving on the shore, these Christians, so-called Christians, even though Dr. Carter G. Woodson, who founded ASALA, said that the European lost their Christianity in the Middle Passage. Mm. So we have these Christians on the shores of Virginia deciding, you know, individually how these Africans should be treated. So Mary and Anthony Johnson are Angolan Africans who become indentured servants and then pay off their servitude and become people with their own land, with servants of their own, African and European servants of their own in the 1600s. These lawmakers in the House of Burgess is created a month before the Africans arrive. They create this government, and one has to be vested as landowners in the colony to become a lawmaker. Here's a perfect storm for oppression. Since there are no European or English laws covering these people who have arrived from Africa, these landholder lawmakers decide to create laws that would better their interests. Why not have long-term servitude? That way, when the people learn their skills, they can keep them on later on, and they don't have to compete against the Africans who have shown through Mary Nancy Johnson that they are keen competitors in this colony. They chase Mary Nancy Johnson out of the colony, confiscate their land, create laws that make any baby born of an African woman, even if they have an English father, make that baby enslaved at birth, and then start this whole idea of this agrarian entrepreneurship that they're now applauding themselves for based on the land stolen from the Native Americans and the bodies of these laborers who are not allowed to use their intellect but only their physical being to create a land they claim now is their own if they did it all themselves under this guise of liberty for all. So it's like, how does it fit? It's everywhere.
I want us to pick up, because there's a historical foundation that most folk probably in our country really don't know that really plays out in even the present. But most people don't know what you're getting into, which is like the structural exclusion that we see still playing out. If you could continue, that would be perfect.
I'm going to say this, Robert, that this is about competition and greed. These elements are very human. They're across the board in every country, in every language, ethnicity, religion. Competition and greed, but it also includes law. And as someone who's a legal historian, as well as a civil rights attorney, when we look at the role law played and the fact that the lawmakers were able to deepen their pockets and make themselves wealthy off of tobacco, but tobacco is very labor-intensive. And so you have this competitor. And think about it. If you could reduce your competitor to not be able to compete against you, because these people were dying in this colony. They had a time that was called a starving time between 1608 and 1609, in which cannibalism, recorded cases, cannibalism, taking place in this colony. The Native Americans were attacking the fort of Jamestown. They couldn't leave to go get food. This one woman had her baby cut out from her. That, you know, these were horrendous times in this colony before Africans ever set foot on the shores of Virginia. And so not only did the Africans know how to grow crops, which these urbanites didn't really know from Europe, but they also knew how to tend cattle, and they had metalwork skills. They were skilled people. They came from a civilized place. They had their own language and structure, so they had to learn English. They had to learn the ideas of this culture there. They did all this, and they began to thrive, and I think that really threatened the sense of self of the Europeans in the colony, and they used their law to make them underdogs in the fight. And then use law as murder as a consequence for resisting the legal subjugation that they were supposed to accept as people lesser than by God and by man. So we see a lot of these messages are remnants of this legal oppression playing itself out for the next 400 years.
Right. And I think the intersection with this conversation then is to then make a national commemoration then brings all of this back up.
Yes.
Have you found in your time in working not only as a legal historian and lawyer, but as a chair and a curator of this time and of commemoration, I guess those challenges come up in the larger community, much less in the diaspora community of African descendants.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I was changed this weekend, and I'm still trying to figure out the many ways in which I have been changed, but change actually took place. We had a Native American leader give a speech welcoming African people to these shores. Just think about that. A simple thing. We've never been welcomed to these shores.
Mm-hmm.
That is change, you know, worthy right there. We had white political leaders ask for forgiveness for the deeds of their ancestors, because it should not be on the shoulders of people of African descent that we have to do all the forgiving. I mean, there was a forgiveness ceremony, and I participated in that, but forgiveness must take place across the board, and that involves even those people who are immigrants to the country, because those people have said, well, I had nothing to do with this. My people weren't even here, but you're here to benefit from the struggle. You can't go into a beautifully created house and not ask yourself one time, who built this house? And show any gratitude toward the people who built it. And those people, through legal challenges, who have made life better for everyone in this country. The civil rights movement and the hundreds of civil rights cases that were brought before the Supreme Court created and expanded protections for everyone, not just people of African descent. So when we look at 400 years of perseverance, which is how I coin it, this was a weekend that showed 400 years of navigating a system of oppression and still maintaining our humanity when people said we weren't human, burned us alive, hung us, you know, cut off pieces of our body, raped women and used their children for labor and sold them on the auction block. This country's history is in murder and oppression, and yet at the same time diabolically devised to give the world the impression of true liberty for all. So it's been a difficult road, but I think this weekend is a space for us to use as a pivoting point to go forward as a better nation.
Yeah, we should talk about those events. And you're saying those, I know you're referencing the events at Hampton Roads in Virginia, which literally became, is actually where Jamestown was.
Yes.
Now, and that's what you're referencing in those events that happened in Hampton, Virginia, correct?
Yes, because the Africans actually arrived in what is now called Hampton Roads or Hampton, Virginia. Jamestown was further up the road, and I am in off of the Jamestown-Williamsburg area. I am in that area right now in Virginia as I continue to take in the different sites and scenes of the times of this commemoration. But I wanted us to know that Jamestown was where the government was, but the arrival of the Africans was Hampton Roads, where Hampton University is and where my program took place on Friday. What we need to understand is there was a group of leaders, the Pierce family and other families of the Europeans who were here, and it was already a caste system in place among the Europeans, where you had white indentured servants or so-called white slaves who had to work for a certain amount of time without pay until they paid off their indenturement. They were the lower caste, and so you had these wealthy people who decided, well, I'm going to take a couple of Africans, because when they arrived, as you pointed out, on the White Lion, that ship had been through the destruction of the battle, stealing the Africans in the first place, and so these Africans were traded for provisions for those people on that ship. And so now you have the beginning of these Africans that were then taken up to Jamestown and passed around, you know, as the people decided, I want one, and passed around and lived in certain houses. So we have the names of certain Africans who were in the colony, but there are many more who go nameless.
We're talking to Professor Gloria Brown Marshall. She was the chair, is the chair of the commemoration of 400 years of chattel slavery, 400 years of perseverance, which we'll get into right now, because the Association for the Study of African American Life and History is also a testament of actually perseverance from the African American culture. Can we talk a little bit about that organization and its founder Carter G. Woodson, who is the founder of Black History?
A founder of Black History scholarship. Think about this. In 1915, the white historians did not believe that the African American had a history, that there was no contribution to the universal thought of the arts, of science, of anything. Now, we've had Timbuktu, we have the pyramids still standing today, where people, white scientists from around the world, for centuries have been unable to even devise any similar science that could give them the ability to create the pyramids today. And so here we have, you know, peoples of African descent from South Africa all the way up to Egypt and Libya and Liberia across the continent, And people believed that we had given nothing to contribute to the man, to mankind or womankind. And so Carter G. Woodson decided that we must study ourselves and then record that, print it, publish it, and just make it a consistent contribution, not just to the community, but to the world, even if they don't recognize it as such now. And because Dr. Carter G. Woodson, a graduate of Harvard, who did this, we have this sense of course we study African-American history today. This was unheard of in 1915, except within a small group within the African-American community.
And how did you become a part of this organization and consequently the chair of the commemoration of Perseverance, which I would love for you to get into as well, why it was called the Commemoration of Perseverance?
Well, over 10 years ago, I was coming down to Virginia working on my book, Race, Law, and American Society, 1607 to the Present, and working on other colonial legal history from a racial component. And I began because I was, as a civil rights attorney, I was sitting in a little motel in a little town off the Gulf Shores of Alabama, and I was asking myself as a civil rights attorney, how long have we been fighting? How long have we been gathering together and trying to come up with strategies to make sure that not just law, but society recognize our full citizenship and humanity? And I went through the 1950s, and I was in 1800s. Then I saw that we had civil rights activists like Prince Hall back in the 1700s and Mum Bett. Then I went even further and found Elizabeth Key in the 1600s. And I said, you know, we have been doing this for centuries. And that's when I looked at the start of the Virginia colony, which began in 1607, and the arrival of the Africans in 1619, and realized we have to tell the full story of perseverance, because our story is not just oppression. Oppression means that we don't have our own agency. We don't have courage. And not only do we have courage, not only do we have creativity and perseverance and resistance with the different African uprisings, not just Nat Turner and other ones like Denmark Vesey, but other ones where they refused to put them in the history books because they did not want to encourage other Africans to rise up. But the laws themselves would indicate not just the cruel tortures of any African who escaped and was brought back, but rose up. I mean, you think about Nat Turner was not only hung, he was skinned. His head was put on a pike, and then that head, that skull, was passed around through different families because they thought it had some type of magical power. There were dozens of other Africans who were killed in the same time of Nat Turner just to send a message that you shall not rise up. Freedom is against the law. That's a crime. And being able to stand up as a human being is what people wanted to do despite knowing they would be murdered if they were caught. So those things I want to capture, to persevere and gain an education despite being against the law to educate a slave and on point of death. So all of these things give rise to the spirit, the power of the spirit of the African over 400 years in this country. And that is what I wanted to capture with the phrase 400 years of perseverance.
And I'm sure that all of the events then wove that spirit and curatorial focus. Why do you think then it's such a difficult thing for America to talk about this issue? And even our listening public, normally we would get calls at this program, and we haven't really received. And I would love for folk to call in and have questions and comments. But why do you think we aren't having the questions and comments and outright conversations about this issue, especially on this anniversary?
Well, I'm going to say the people are listening because I will believe, and I truly believe, that they're enthralled with this conversation because it's not one we really have. I am very proud to be an African American. How often do people, any stripe, hear that phrase? How often do they know of the courageous ability to maintain our humanity to the point where we're having this conversation right now, that we were not driven insane by the hypocrisy of a country that's telling the world this is all about liberty and yet oppressing us at every turn? and still maintaining a godlike appreciation for another human being when, you know, news reports still want to only focus on black deviants and want to make the black family into something that's always dysfunctional. I mean, we had our families torn apart, sold on the auction block. And we have to understand that if my ancestors have to bear their part of responsibility of our nation's history, their ancestors, European ancestors, must do so as well. When we see the photographs of those hanging bodies, people burned alive and lynched in different parts of the country, not just the Deep South, it happened often there, but other parts of the country, then we need to know those people standing below those hanging bodies are also complicit in the murder. And we can't just turn our backs and say, I just can't take the guilt, because racism is born of guilt. We'll say, well, those people deserved it because God said, that's they use religion. God said you're descendants of Ham and therefore you're supposed to be servants, or you are such bad people, you deserve everything you get. So therefore, I don't feel so guilty about my role in benefiting from all that's been done to people of African descent. We must go forward. When we have someone like Dylann Ruff, you know, murder 80-year-old women in cold blood in a church, and we don't rise up, when we have police officers shooting black people in the back in the street, and we don't rise up, white, black, Latino, Jewish, you know, Muslim, all people know when oppression is taking place, and this country is made up of too many people who have left oppression to come here to turn their backs on the oppression that takes place every day toward the African-American community. So a scholar not only studies the greatness of the African-American community and the Africana community abroad, but it also leaves a record that anybody could access going to ASALH.org, Asala, ASALH.org, and you can see the scholarship, you can read the books, and you can take this in as each person is willing or able to do.
Yeah, I would suggest that folks who don't know about Asala to go to the website. It is very comprehensive and is an archival space for over 115 years of information that you might not have ever heard of, or you may have heard of but want to have some more poignant information to be able to access. I was going to ask you why you think it is important for America to commemorate the African chattel experience, but I think you got to that to some degree. But even more so, can you like tell me why and tell us why then America should commemorate this date?
Well, the commemoration started this year because it was 1619 they arrived, and so this 400-year period. My mentor, who passed away in 2015, was in her 80s, and this is what she wanted to see, to know. I feel honored that I lived in this time, that I'm able to see not only a black president, but the 400th. But I think it's necessary for, as the Native American chiefess and Richardson said, welcome to these shores. We appreciate what you've given. America would not be America without the African American. And that's every aspect. We're talking about the astronaut to the ballerina, to the teacher, to the historian, the politician. You know, we are human beings. We love our mother like you love your mother. We are part of this humanity. And I think it took this 400th commemoration, not just for the African-American community to understand that we have been navigating this for so long, but for all other people, including the descendants of those people who oppressed African-Americans, to understand you can run, but you cannot hide. 400 years ago, I'm able to go back and look at the research and look at the journals from 400 years ago. How will you be written down in the book? How will the historians 100 or 400 years from now look at what white America is doing when they look at this research, especially this backlash of nationalism that we're dealing with? You will be in the book of history. How will you be written? So I think the 400th commemoration means we've got to look at where we've been in Sankofa, know where we are to be a better judge of where we're going, and you will be in the book of history. We have a choice as to how we'll be written in that book.
Yeah, and we're going to come back for the next segment. I'm talking to Gloria Brown Marshall. And I'd love to get into that piece because we're starting to hear more and more as the presidential year comes, the conversation around reparations and the conversation around chattel slavery. And I'd love to get your point of view on this reference and why now? Is it a part of the 400th? Is it a part because we have people of color running, black folks running for president? Professor Brown Marshall, there are a lot of conversations going on connected to the institution of slavery and what is a resurgence of conversations around reparations that have been a part of the presidential campaign, but also just a part of the zeitgeist, you could say. Do you think that this is a function of just, you know, divine time, if you will, or is it, you know, is the anniversary prompting this? What do you think?
Well, the first conversation about reparations took place within a year of the end of slavery in 1865. Mm. By 1870, when we started looking at not just the fact that equal protection had been given under the 14th Amendment of 1868, by 1870, black men gained the right to vote. And politicians, black politicians in the U.S. Senate, in the U.S. House of Representatives, that's how long we've been talking about reparations. Callie House, C-A-L-L-I-E, Callie House was a leader in the reparations movement in the 1800s. Mm. So this is not just today. There are organizations like NCOBRA that have been talking about reparations for a generation. Mm-hmm. I think it's bubbled up to the national conversation because we've had a push by people in political positions, people of African descent as well as other whites who have been talking about reparations. My concern is this, Robert, that we not only have a conversation, but we have to have an acknowledgement. This country has never officially even acknowledged enslavement of Africans to build this country. Mm-hmm. And from what we see in the political, you know, discussion right now with the backlash to the New York Times 1619 Project, we have people who still want to pretend as though the North didn't use black troops to win the war. But for the black soldiers in the Civil War, the North would have lost the war. We have been pivotal to this country's development. And yet people want to believe that not only are we a burden to the development of this country, but that we added nothing to it. So there's so much that we have to talk about that people won't, you know, acknowledge for us to get to. How do you pay back people for their contributions if you don't believe they ever contributed anything? Mm-hmm. Because their version of American history is so skewed, it's not even racially founded or motivationally founded in history when it comes to our contributions as Africans. It's founded on this myth that, you know, white Americans created this country alone. There are people who will hold on to that myth no matter what the reality is.
Yeah, the authors of that project and the New York Times Magazine have an interview on the web talking about the challenge of centering this conversation in the African-American culture versus it being centered for so long historically in white culture, and the challenge that comes with then doing that centering to African Americans, which then makes you have to atone. And yeah, that becomes the challenge.
But Robert, think about this. I feel this way sincerely. Children, white children and black children, all children, are being raised and educated based on a myth that only white people built this country. And unfortunately, and I'll say this because you're on the West Coast, unfortunately, too many people in the movie business have continued this myth. Too many films were made in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s in which people of African descent and other people of color were totally left out of the film. So you would think only white people were in this country. And even today, you see so many programs that only have whites in it. And I'll say this to your movie-making population in California. Stop this propaganda of flying to Africa to film things in which you have Africans throwing spears and huts. They know they're flying and landing in the airport, staying at 4- and 5-star hotels with swimming pools, driving Mercedes on roads, and just to film Africans throwing spears when they know it's not true. And the movie business has become part of the propaganda, undermining how people think about Africans and African Americans, and you need to stop. This is a charge to Hollywood and the rest of the movie making business. Stop the propaganda showing all these Africans out in the middle of the jungle somewhere when you know it's not true. My other concern is, and I'll say this very quickly, Robert, how can we have a conversation about the African American role in America's progress when people still don't see African Americans as human? As late as last year, I had a white gentleman ask me, you know, about black people not having a soul. Not having a soul. This was in Indianapolis in 2018 that he said it says in the Bible that black people don't have souls. This is what we're still working with, an FBI that's talking about black identity extremists. So if you actually care, the conversation I'm having right now, I could be labeled a black identity extremist by the FBI because I'm telling the truth about history, American history. And so if you care about your community, if you talk about these things in truthful terms, you want to be labeled an extremist, and that's been the backlash we've seen since, you know, the 1700s to present when it comes to people who want to tell the truth about American history.
Right. And I think that that becomes then the challenge of then letting the history go and consequently it being then erased because of the threat of it's not even an uncover, to your point. It's very, very available if you do the digging to then see, oh, what has been the history of not only oppression, but of literal legality in structures. But then what then is the charge of folk in this time, given, you know, the risks, but that have been historic, right? I think, you know, we all know that, you know, they haven't changed in that regard. What is the charge for folk, you know, from your point of view, to do and continue to uncover?
Well, my book, Race, Law, and American Society, look at the ways in which law oppressed, undermined the progress of African Americans in almost every aspect of life over centuries. Race, law, and American society. Until we look at the law, if we have, and I'm not saying we shouldn't, if we have more black judges, more black lawyers, more black police officers, but they're all enforcing the same racially skewed laws, then we're not going to make the progress we need. We need to look at the criminal justice system and finally say this is based on the societal thought that blacks are more, you know, criminally based or have this latent gene of criminality. Well, we know that it's not true. We look at the drug wars and we see now that people are making money off of marijuana, how many black young people or older people are in prison or have prison records based on the same drug use or even lesser than whites? The whites were the ones who are allowed to take the drugs, and now they're the ones allowed to make millions off of marijuana, and you have criminal records in the African community undermining their ability to get a job and an education. The differences, disparities, the way that the things have been skewed based on law, you know, it's so endemic in our society that we have to really be honest with ourselves that law is not just something that falls from the sky. It was created to maintain this uneven competition, as was done back in the 1600s, the vestiges of what we're living with now. The other is we're not trying to wipe out white America. And that's been the backlash. Oh, you want us to disappear. You don't want us to be a part of our own country. And that is not true. I want everybody to like themselves, like who you are, but also know that you don't have to oppress someone else in order to give yourself, your ethnicity, your religion, or whatever it may be, lifted up. You can lift it up without stepping on somebody else. And that has not been something we teach in America. It seems like a dog-eat-dog kind of world where in order for you to advance, you've got to crush your neighbor. And it's easier to crush your neighbor you can identify by race or religion. And that is something we need to get away from in America going forward for this country to stand as tall as it can and go as far as it can.
I'm talking to Professor Gloria Brown Marshall around the issues of chattel slavery, as this past weekend was the 400th commemoration of enslaved Africans arriving in what would become the United States of America. You hit a lot of huge points in that last portion of your time, and I think a thread that I pulled though is, you know, again, the authors of the New York Times 1619 Project talked about also the parallel of other Holocausts, you know, to other communities, and used the Jewish community as an example that there would never be a backlash to facts in that community around the Holocaust and that genocide, but to this point, because there was a time when in that country, in Germany, there was a denazification, they called it, that happened in order to clear the space, and that we never did that. And in fact, the people that did become lawmakers in the South and in the North, for that matter, were the same people who were part of the structural supremacy of white folk.
Well, when you think about the Angola prison in Louisiana, it's at the site of the Angola plantation. Right. Think about the connection between the prison industrial complex and how, you know, people have now built communities around the imprisonment of Africans. So you're going to use their bodies to make money. This country has not gotten away from the idea that African people, people of African descent and African Americans, are to be used to enrich themselves without thinking that this is a human being I am debasing, I am using for my own economic benefit. And for generational purposes, I'm going to undermine their progress because that's going to lift up me and my family. And that guilt then, once again, as we did in the 1600s, then says, okay, but this person of this other race deserves this. We're doing the same thing today that we were doing 400 years ago, and we're not going to get any further. And once again, I say, this is the 400th commemoration of the African presence in the Virginia colony and the 400 years of preservation, of perseverance and preserving the family through courage, resistance, and creativity. The Maafa, M-A-A-F-A, is what we call the African Holocaust, mm-hmm. The Maafa. And I think we have to be very clear that we're not going to go where we need to go until we realize where we've been. And that's what this 400 commemoration allows us to do.
Most definitely. We have about a couple minutes left, and I wanted to connect also countries such as Ghana that offered a whole year of events and invitations back to descendants of the Maafa to return and even settle in Ghana. What do you think about that offering, which has been around? I guess we should say that, you know, Ghana's offered dual citizenship for over 20 years, but, you know, in the spirit of dynamic and connection and holistic conversation, you know, Ghana offering and West African conversations offering space and us not, the United States not, I think is kind of an interesting comment.
Well, let's put it this way. I've traveled to Ghana twice, and I've gone to the slave pens, and Ghana did something that was very important. First, they asked for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. They set out their contrition. Mm-hmm. The Africans played a role in the slave trade. We have to be very honest about this. And so during this past weekend, we had people from Nigeria, delegations from Nigeria, as well as Ghana, who asked for forgiveness for their role in the slave trade. This is what America has never done. It is almost as though this diabolical sense of, if I ignore it, it'll go away, and people will think that the Africans and people of color and Native Americans are the liars, and that we hold the truth, when, as I said before, it's written down in the book. It was written down 400 years ago. We were able to find the line, and we can find it directly even now more than ever. How are people going to be written in the book of history if they keep denying what obviously happened in this country? And that is to be able to say, yes, we played a role in the slave trade. Please forgive us for this role we played. And let's go forward as a better nation, having acknowledged what has been done to other people and their contribution as well.
Professor Gloria Brown Marshall, good to speak with you, and many, many thanks.
Thank you.